Welcome to Take Heart, where our goal is to offer encouragement, give hope and insight, so you can flourish in your journey as a special needs mom. Hello, this is Amy Brown, and welcome to episode 137 of Take Heart. I am so excited to introduce you to our guest today. Her books have been very influential in my life. We have on the show today, Andi Kolber. Andi is a licensed professional counselor. She is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Try Softer, and she has a new book, Strong Like Water, Finding the Freedom, Safety, and Compassion to Move Through Hard Things and Experience True Flourishing. She has received additional training in her specialization of trauma and body-centered therapies and is passionate about the integration of faith in psychology. Andi speaks regularly at local and national events, and she has appeared on podcasts such as The Lazy Genius with Kendra Adachi, Typology, Go and Tell Gals, and The Next Right Thing with Emily P. Freeman. As a survivor of trauma, Andi brings hard-won knowledge about the work of change, the power of redemption, and the beauty of experiencing God with us in our pain. Andi, thank you so much for being here today on Take Heart. I am thrilled to be talking to you. For our listeners who don't know you, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm Andi Kolber, and I am a licensed therapist. I've been doing this work for about 16 years. I specialize in trauma and sort of trauma-informed perspectives. I'm also married, and I have two kiddos. And you and I were talking before we hit record, and we recently, well, it's been about a year, moved from Colorado to Michigan. And so that's been a huge transition in our life as well.
Well, I'm a fan of Michigan, as I just told you. So I hope that you are enjoying the state. It's not great in the winter.
But it definitely has some strong winter vibes. No, yeah. But I do. It is beautiful and enjoying the seasons, enjoying the water. Feel really grateful to be here.
Good, good. Well, I first met you through your book, Try Softer. And I remember when I picked it up, I had the realization that no one ever told me it was okay to try softer. Like, I was like, what? What is try softer? Because I think we have this idea, we try really hard or we're just like doing nothing. As a special needs moms, we're always advocating 10 steps ahead. I think we have a lot of worst case scenario mindset. I shared with you earlier, I have kids with reactive attachment disorder. There's always some catastrophe around the corner. We'll have moments of calm and then we'll have outbursts. So you just never know when the next hard thing is going to happen. And so I think that leads us into kind of a worst case scenario scarcity mindset. And for our listeners who have medically complex kids, that's the case too, because you never know when you're going to have to rush to the hospital or...
Yeah.
So our tendency, I think, as any, all of us, but particularly to special needs moms, is to, you know, buck up, white knuckle it. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about what you mean by trying softer. And also, what do you think gets in the way of us trying softer?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I want to actually just say is to just really honor, you know, what you're naming here. And that is, I think, the validity of why we push so hard and why we white knuckle it, and the validity of that there is a reality that needs to be met, and that our body is doing their best to meet the reality. Like it's not like we're not just like, ooh, how can I make my life hard? When I think sometimes when you're trying to respond to an emergency with your kids or an urgent need, right? Mm-hmm. And I say that because I think sometimes, especially sort of in like the self-help world, there can be this like sort of way of seeing things like just change your mindset, like just like flip a switch just think your way into a new way of being. And listen, it's not to say that how we think doesn't matter, but I think sometimes what we first need to do is really honor reality. And so for listeners, who have kiddos who've got very complex medical issues, emotional issues, I want to first say that that is valid and it's real. Mm-hmm. And that when our bodies respond from a place of feeling like this is dangerous, that I think that we want to say, okay, that makes sense. it makes sense that we might be responding that way, because the reality is it probably is urgent. Right. It may be a crisis. It may be hard. And then what's difficult about that is that pattern, the pattern of having to respond that way, begins to live in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And that makes it like, rather than being a one-off time where your body does exactly what they're supposed to do, which is like, if there's threat, we respond from a place of wanting to alleviate the threat. What can begin to happen is that we begin to live that way. Right. It begins to be our default position in every part of our life. And so what I would say is that when I talk about this idea of try softer, it's not to minimize mm-hmm. the reality of our experience. Instead, I think what we can begin to do is learn to come to reality and turn towards reality with compassion, mm-hmm. turn towards our own experience and how we are experiencing our lives with that. I talk about in the book, compassionate attention. Mm-hmm. And so this requires us to hold some nuance. Like, sometimes we do need to go into some fight or flight energy or into some that responsive energy. But if we can also learn to pay compassionate attention, what happens is that our body is able to better metabolize, like digest, when that threat has passed. So that rather than living from a place of constant crisis, we begin to say, okay, what do I need? Mm-hmm. What do my kids need? We're able to more accurately assess
right.
what's happening versus having to live even once the threat has passed mm-hmm. from this white knuckled crisis position. Mm-hmm. And so I know I'm kind of answering your question backwards, because I think that's why we white knuckle, right?
Right.
It's because life happens
right.
and because trauma can happen and because our bodies are designed to navigate threat. Like, and I think that's actually a gift right. that our bodies can do that. Thank goodness. Because what would happen if they didn't? We wouldn't have the ability sometimes to get ourselves or our kids what they really need. Mm-hmm. But the work that so many of us need to do is we live in a culture that sort of socializes us into never resting, right. socializes us into acting like we're fine when we're not fine. Socializes us into not feeling our feelings. And I think the work of learning to try softer is not to act as though there's never going to be threat or harm that we need to navigate, mm-hmm. but instead honoring it. And then as we're able, really bringing that compassionate attention to our experience.
Mm-hmm. I love that phrase, compassionate attention. I think in a life, if you're at the hospital bedside of your child that's medically complex, or you have children like I have that have extreme violent outbursts, you know, mm-hmm. you want to have compassionate attention for your child, but I don't think we always turn that back on ourselves. I think we just keep going. We're at the bedside for hours and it's medically complex and it's scary and we just go to the next thing. Or like in my situation, having a child come at me, even though I'm bigger and I'm the parent, is still my body's still scared of it. But I don't think I realized that for a really long time. I just thought, oh, she's just a kid. But having somebody charge at you in anger, your body should pay attention to that. So I love that idea of compassionate attention. But I don't think we put that lens on ourselves very often. I think it's the kids and how do we get to help the kids? So, what are some of the ways you think we can start paying attention? Like after a situation, let's give the example of extreme another hospital stay. In that moment, and even after that moment, how do we start paying attention?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Well, so one thing I just want to acknowledge is that oftentimes, I mean, we can't do this alone. Mm-hmm. And so there's parts of this that I recognize that different people are going to have access to different levels of support and resources. Mm-hmm. And so I want to name that and acknowledge that, because a lot of what I talk about in the book is very much an internal process. And when you don't have a team or a support or those things, your body is more likely to stay in a place of, you know, in the book, I talk about like the window of tolerance, right? Mm-hmm. So the window is that range of arousal where we sort of are able to be our full self. We have access to our resources. We have access to our full brain. We are able to better regulate. Our body is able to regenerate when something difficult has happened. But when we are, for example, beyond our limits for long periods of time and we don't have support, even when we have the knowledge that of what to do, we may not always be able to return to that window. Mm-hmm. And so I just name that as a truth of almost, I hope that it's that there's compassion that can come from knowing that we are both resilient and fragile. And all of that is part of who we are. And with that said, I do think that there are things that we can do. So going back to this example that you name about, you know, it's like another medical emergency that's happened. You're in the hospital, you're getting home. One of the things I like to talk to folks about who are dealing with a lot of crisis is thinking of it like, when we try to automatically go to like our higher order thinking, so like planning ahead and what do I need to do 3 years from now? Mm-hmm. And you are barely like surviving this moment. First of all, whatever like emotional state you're in, like if you're in like a fight or flight state, what we know is that that emotional state will impact your ability to plan, for example. Mm-hmm. So like your feelings of like, you know, fear, dread, anxiety, like will be very much imprinted on whatever you try to decide. So what I actually really recommend for folks is to actually reframe that from the place of like, if I don't have sort of my basic sanity, then I almost can't do anything else.
Right.
Like I can't plan ahead. I can't, all these other more complex things, they have to be secondary to, I mean, this is such a, like a cliche, it's become so cliche, but literally until we have sort of that mask on ourselves, right? Like on an airplane, unless you put the oxygen on yourself, you will pass out. Right. In the process of trying to put it on your child.
Right.
Like, and there's a truth to that. And from a neurobiological standpoint, what I would say is that it's very much true. Mm-hmm. And so this is where practices like, you know, in a lot of my books, I always start with things like grounding mm-hmm. or really basic safe, like helping to create safety in the moment. So grounding is just the utilization of our five senses to come into like the immediacy of the moment, because God willing, like this immediate moment, not 5 minutes from now and not 5 minutes in the past, but right now, we can maybe find a moment that there is a sense of enough safety. It doesn't have to be perfect. And so you can do this a lot of different ways. You know, you can, you know, like you can name everything like in your immediate presence, you know, like I'm aware of this pen and I can tell you about the weight of the pen and I can tell you about the colors of the pen and I can tell you that the pen makes a very thin line. Like I'm using all my senses to literally zoom in and to become very aware. A lot of times I say, if you can get outside mm-hmm. and you know, put your feet in the grass and notice what you can smell and what you can see. And for a lot of folks, if you've never heard of something like this might sound a little silly, And I like, I get it, but I come from a body-centered somatic sort of lens. And what I can tell you is I've done this probably thousands of times with people. And this is one of the most accessible practices that we can begin to do, because our body is literally, what we're doing is we're trying to pick up cues of safety. And if we can really zoom into the moment, we can find safety that can bring us back into that window. And when we come back into that window, our more of our full brain is available. And this is the place from which it's a, it's such a better place to make decisions, to begin to plan, to begin to say, okay, well, what does my family need, or what needs to happen next here? Another thing that I might just say in addition to something like grounding is connecting with people that on a body level bring you a sense of that ability. I kind of talk about it like a person that you feel like you can exhale when you are with them. Like that is a sign from your body that we are down-regulating, or potentially we may be up-regulating if we've gone down into more of a dissociative place, that we're able to access more of those natural systems of our body. And part of what happens when we're in the presence, and that could even be through a phone call, just hearing the sound of that person's voice or seeing them on like FaceTime, for example, those bring cues to our body, and that expands our window of tolerance. And that, I think a lot of people have that sense that go where they go from a place of like, oh my gosh, I cannot handle another thing, to going to that place of like, man, I wish I didn't have to deal with this, but I'm going to take a breath, kind of get my feet under me, and I'm just going to make that next right decision. So those are just like two really basic examples of beginning to sort of get our feet underneath us again.
I love those. And I will say, I will attest that if you're not familiar with this, and you have great practices in both your books, and every time I would read one, I go, this is really going to work, but it does work. Like it should be
you're
a bigger,
not alone.
It should be a bigger thing. It shouldn't be that simple. But I think one of the keys, and you talk about this, is you use the word compassionate attention. Like, I think I have been in fighter. I did not realize that I had been in fight or flight. But I've been in that for so long because I wasn't like running around like a chicken with my head cut off. I go into super focused, over-educating, over-solving.
Yes.
And that is what I look like out of my window of tolerance. And I don't think I would have understood that if I hadn't had this language to understand it, and then took it to my own therapist and said, help me get through this. And because I just assume fight or flight means you're running like chicken with your head cut off, or you're like, I didn't understand that my particular brand of out of my winter of tolerance is just the gas pedal is on acceleration, and I am doing everything, and I'm learning, and I don't take a breath. And I recently, this past January, a really dear family friend of ours, he's like a son to me, was in a very bad car accident. And I'm a nurse, so I'm his medical power of attorney. So I was at his bedside, and I had done this work that you talked about, and I got so far outside my window of tolerance, and I just kept going because I'm actually good at a bedside. I'm a good advocate. So I was good at it on top of that. And I ended up getting so far gone that I had to step away and call a friend. And I said, I'm so far gone, I can't even put up a boundary at this point. And she's like, okay. And she put me right back. Just that conversation caused me to stop. And I didn't have to leave the hospital and rearrange everything that I had been doing. I just needed to stop for a minute and then say, okay, I can't spend the night at the bedside. That's just not, that's not the best thing for me. And I even was able to go into my friend and go, I can stay at the bedside, but if you want to utilize me to the best of my ability, I need to sleep. You know, and that's, but that, I don't think I would have said that even 2 years ago. I think I just would have kept going, not realizing that that's where I was. So paying attention to that, even in not so stressful moments, some of us have things that trigger us. If, you know, example for in parents of kids with behavioral issues, the phone call from the school is very triggering because it's always bad news, right? So even noticing little things, it has helped, it's given me a language to understand and to pay attention to what's going on in my, how it feels in my body. And I'm getting a little bit better at recognizing that. So thank you for saying that. And I think it comes back to paying attention.
We have vastly misunderstood and miscategorized what we describe as things like trauma in our culture. I mean, and it's not, it's because we haven't made it broad enough, right?
Right.
Like that, like, because from a practical lens, what we're talking about is those experiences that our body doesn't have the capacity to process. And because we don't have the capacity, they become fragmented in our body. Mm-hmm. And when we say they become triggered, what we mean is that because it wasn't fully processed, the fragments, we get re-experienced as though they're happening in the present. So whether you're talking about an experience of full-on PTSD, or you're talking about something that is disturbing but doesn't meet the criteria of PTSD, both are being re-experienced and both are worthy of care.
Right. I love that. Let's talk about your next book, because continues on with, and I think that's what you said, it's like the next installment. Is there another installment, or do you not want to talk about that right now?
Still kind of working on it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you talk in Strong Like Water about situational strength. And I read that and was like, oh my gosh, that is what I do all the time, because I have what we call, special needs moms have the Mother Teresa complex. Like, you're so strong. I don't know how you do it. We could never do what you do. And that that makes us feel more isolated, because we feel like we can't go, no, this is hard. I don't like this. I don't want this. So can you explain situational strength and also what that costs us when we stay in situational strength?
Well, I'm so glad you asked this question, because as you were describing what you're like when you go out of your window of tolerance, that's what it reminds me of, is that you have learned, like you have a, what I'm hearing you say is that you have adapted by developing a way to advocate, but it you're out of your window, but it has served a purpose, right? There's a way in which you've needed it. And so in Strong Like Water, the case I try to make is to say, what can happen when we sort of live outside of our window of tolerance for too long, and it doesn't get resolved, is that our situational strength, we develop strategies. And it's not just fight or flight. It gets to be like hypervigilance or extreme, or even things like being checked out and seeming numb, like you don't care. All of that, is a signal that you're out of your window of tolerance, but B, has likely developed because you've needed it. And so I talk about situational strength as a type of survival strength that we go to when we are out of our window of tolerance, but that we have needed to help us navigate either real or perceived experiences that have felt to be or have actually been life or death, right? And that could be life or death to us, but it could also be life or death to others. It could be the experience of, as a child, it felt life or death, right? Like maybe to an adult, it wouldn't have been life or death, but to you as a child, feeling disconnected from your family because you didn't get the care you needed as a child, that is experienced in your body or could be experienced as life or death, right? So I really unpack, and I try to give a lot of different types of examples of situational strength. But ultimately, what I really hope is that readers sort of figure out their own patterns of how they have developed situational strength, and that one, we can honor it. Like, sort of, why have I needed situational strength? Like, what purpose has this served in my life? So that's the first hope. But the second hope is to say, understanding that maybe we've needed it, but also understanding that it's not sustainable. And understanding that it's not necessarily that it's bad to have situational strength. In fact, we all need it. We need to be able to tap into that at times. But if we live from it, I mean, the experiences of adrenaline, cortisol, living outside of your window of tolerance, the allostatic mm-hmm. load of what that costs us is profoundly high, right? We know from, for example, there's been a lot of research around the adverse childhood experiences, sort of assessments of like when folks have lots of toxic stress experiences and those don't get resolved, mm-hmm. That correlates in adulthood with just numerous health issues, mental health issues, addiction. Mm-hmm. And so I share that to say all of this is related, right? It's not that stress in and of itself is necessarily bad. Sometimes we need our body to respond to what's in front of us. But when we don't have the support we need, when we don't have the safety we need to return to that window of tolerance, and our body needs to be able to experience that situation as though it has ended, it keeps us stuck in situational mm-hmm. strength. And in Strong Like Water, I really expand this idea to say, listen, situational strength is necessary. And as we begin to have those resources and some safety, we move into a more expansive type of strength. We move along what I call the flow of strength into experiences like transitional mm-hmm. strength. So this is where we begin to have more choice about, it's sort of like a lot of try softer happens in mm-hmm. transitional strength. We begin to become aware of our pain. We begin to say, yes, this is hard. What else is available to me? How can I care for myself? Who is in my corner? Who is on my team? And then as that happens, we also ultimately begin to tap into our body's natural ability to process pain, and we move towards experiences of integrated mm-hmm. strength, which is that holistic sense of that feeling when something fully feels like we've been able to process through it, and we can now learn from it or gain more mm-hmm. insight from
yeah.
it.
That's so good. And I think one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading this is, you know, I've go to a therapist, I've read your books, but what would you say to those people that are like, but this is going to take a long time and it seems like it's a lot. I mean, you know, like I feel personally that just reading, I was like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And it just started my curiosity mm-hmm. of, and I'm older too. And I have, my kids are, I'm not with little kids right now. I have older teen kids and adult kids. So I think that part of my life, I've started to have more space to think about it, but I don't want younger moms to say, oh, I'll wait till they're all adults till I deal with this. Mm-hmm. So it does take mm-hmm. a long time, mm-hmm. but I think that thing that encouraged me about your books are they're small little steps along the way that get us there. So what would you say to a listener? Like, this is, seems hard. I don't want to do it because it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. Well, I totally get that. I mean, in TriSofter, the very first story that I tell is, you know, is like a client being like, so how long is this going to take? I mean, I can't tell you how common it is. I mean, we're human and it's totally normal that we're like, ugh, I don't want to look at my pain. I don't want to, you know, any, like we naturally find ways to want to not touch on our pain. And so I think that's valid. And what I would just say is that, at, you know, I always tell people, and I try to really have this come through in my books, is to say, like, you get to do this mm-hmm. in your own way and at your own pace. So it's like, if you read these books, I try to come from this place of like, if you read a chapter, like, and that's all that you read, I think that you'll walk away mm-hmm. with something that you could actually use. And if that's all that you ever read, okay, that's fair. Like, I really come from mm-hmm. a place of like, this is your journey. This is like, I am not here to tell you your life, right? What I do like to do is to create resources that are accessible, that are written in language. Like if you've never been to therapy, if you've never heard about like body-centered work or any of this, I've tried to write this book and this work in ways that said that is basically like, mm-hmm. there's lots of on-ramps. And so to me, I'm like, be free to like, try it. If it works for you, if it feels good, if you're curious about that, that's awesome. What I want is for mm-hmm. people to have more resources so that right. they don't have to keep living in survival mode. Because what I know, I'm a trauma survivor and I have lived significant portions of my life in survival mode. Mm-hmm. And what I know is that it's pretty hellish. What I know is that sometimes we get to a point where we say, this is so painful and so hard that even if it's hard to heal, mm-hmm. it's worth it to me to try. And what I would say is that both for the person who's maybe a little bit curious, I think that there's resources. And then also for the person who's mm-hmm. like, man, this is not working. There are resources there too. Like I try to come from like that smaller angle,
right.
but I also try to paint that bigger picture of like, there's a different mm-hmm. way to be in the world. It is possible. And I'm not saying it'll be easy, but I do think that there's ways to experience goodness along the way. So we don't have to wait until we're healed to experience goodness. In fact, actually offering ourselves the goodness as we go right. is the work. Right.
And I think too, once you, if you read one chapter, then all of a sudden you're aware and then you start noticing it. You're just like when you're looking for a car and you want a certain kind of car and all of a sudden you see them everywhere. Like you start noticing or you hear things that kind of reinforce what was read. And that it's just kind of like little breadcrumbs along the way, kind of, you know, like, oh, that makes sense because I just read this. I don't think you have to be in a rush to get there. And one of the things I think we don't talk about, and I'm actually, see if I can find this. I think this is in Try Softer. You say, and I love this because I think we have this problem solving. I have a problem. I'm going to solve it. But mm-hmm. you say, when we deny the reality of our experiences, we don't become more of who God designed us to be, but less. There's no way to have mm-hmm. cohesive stories unless we truly embrace all of it. The good, the hard, the bittersweet, the sad, the joyful, the lonely, and the painful. It all counts. And I love that quote because it just makes me think, this is not just about me. Here's a problem. I'm going to solve it and go on. I want to be more of who God created me to be. With my childhood trauma and what that, how that has made me move into the world as a mom of special needs kids, I don't want to be stuck there forever. So that whole idea of God created me, all of us, to be a certain way, and we have to address these things to live fully to who we are to be. And that is more than just, you know, here's a problem, let's solve it, let's move on. It's a more cohesive and rich way to look at this work, which I really love. So thank you for writing that.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you specifically about, we have a listener that wanted me to ask you this, about the siblings of special needs children. In my own life, I shared with you earlier that we have attachment disorder kids. So we've had some pretty intense seasons. And all three of my biological kids, my oldest three, even though they were older than the younger adopted kids, they're all in therapy, and there are times when I feel kind of guilty that they are, but I'm also encouraged it because I just, you know, but my question mm-hmm. is these moms that have kids at home right now, specifically the person I'm thinking of, the special needs child is in the hospital a lot and it's all hands on deck and the kids have to go stay with somebody else. And mm-hmm. so these siblings have trauma mm-hmm. from this. And I know as mothers, as parents of special needs kids, we always worry about the siblings, like, are we doing enough for them? And how do we protect them from trauma? How do we help them work through the trauma? So what advice, practical advice would you give in that regard?
Well, I certainly don't think I have mm-hmm. a perfect answer. I'll just say that from the beginning, because I think this is complex and there's nuance mm-hmm. to every single story. But I do think, and this is, I think, one of the most hopeful pieces of the work that I do, is that experiences that have the potential to become trauma don't necessarily always become mm-hmm. traumatic. And the reason is that when we have the support and care around us, when we have the resources, when our body and we experience, like when on a body level, we perceive that we have what we need. It increases our capacity to move through difficult experiences rather than them becoming trauma. And so I think what that means for a question like this is to look at your kiddo, to look at the kiddos, the siblings, you know, obviously the child who's experiencing the main event of like the medical issues or, you know, whether that's the emotional issues, whatever that is, they obviously are going to need care and resources around them. But almost to bring a perspective, a similar perspective around their siblings, around the idea that when something difficult happens, that's sort of like a mm-hmm. rupture. So the question becomes, what is needed to repair the rupture, right? So if it's a sense of safety that is breached, what does that kiddo need to feel like that experience, that they can feel the feelings associated with that experience in a way that's tolerable to their body, and to have the support around them to be able to move through that. And so that might look like, you know, I think of things like making sure those other kiddos, as much as possible, where do they have stability mm-hmm. in their life that they can depend on? Where are the other adults, whether that be therapy, whether that be other family members, whether that be other close family friends, whether that be folks at school, where are other potential safe attachments, secure attachments that they can be mm-hmm. connecting with when main caregivers mm-hmm. are not available? What are resources around those kiddos that help them to feel mm-hmm. soothed? So whether that's an activity, whether that's art, whether that is, you know, experiences in therapy, whether that's being outside, like all of these things, what we're doing is giving venues and experiences to first increase capacity for processing the experience, and then actually having avenues to process the experience. I think when we have both sides of those, that sets kiddos up to be able to move through it rather than have it be something that is traumatic in that they have to ultimately reprocess mm-hmm. again and again. And I think even sometimes it's also like harm reduction.
Right.
Like maybe you cannot completely shield them from everything, but it's almost like in Strong Like Water, I talk about resourcing almost like bubble wrap. And I mean that in a really positive sense. Like if you've got fine china and you are going to go across the country, man, you want lots of layers of bubble wrap, right? To protect that fine, mm-hmm. fragile china. And I think in many ways, like kiddos, with their not fully developed nervous systems, not fully adults, and really all of us need resources, but it's almost like the resources act as padding mm-hmm. so that when those big mm-hmm. jolts come, it's not that you don't experience the jolt, but there's more cushion to absorb what they're experiencing. So those are experiences, you know, so that's secure relationships, that's healthy activities for them to be doing. That's things like stability, that's connection with the main caregiver, that's having permission to feel their feelings and move their body and begin to learn to listen their body as they need.
I love that. There are two thoughts that came when you were talking about that. I think we think as moms, when we're in the hospital or dealing with a child with issues, is that attention that this special needs child is getting all the attention. And so that's the first thing. Like there's just no way you can give equal attention when you have that. There's just not. So I think we need to take ourselves a little bit off the hook on that. But another thing I make me, so there are other, you gave other ideas of how to resource. It's not just attention, because attention's right. important, but when you're at a bedside for 5 days, there's just no way you're going to give the other kids, you just can't, it's unrealistic. So that's number one. And number two, I think One of the things I learned very early on is that my children had to say what they felt. I think initially I would kind of say things like, okay, guys, just try to be patient. He grew up in an orphanage and he doesn't understand. And like, I would kind of do that kind of mm-hmm. speak. And then it occurred to me, like, of course, they already know that. Like, they're already wonderfully mm-hmm. sensitive children. I need to let them mm-hmm. say, and I wasn't like squashing what they thought, but I think I was trying to make it, I don't know how to even word what I was trying to do, but I stopped doing that. I stopped telling them that because it's obvious they know that. But, and allowing them to say what they wanted to say was a real turning point in our family, because not only was that was a safe place for them to do it in our home, because they can't out in the world, because they're, oh, your sister's a special, like, they're always this kid's mm-hmm. sibling, right? You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? They're not themselves in yeah. public. So
yeah, having some spaces, mm-hmm. like, obviously, you know, we want to be mindful of maybe who we're saying it to, right? So we're not necessarily saying it to that the sibling who's medically fragile, right? But having the ability, you know, for the caregiver or the parent themselves to say to the sibling, like, when we are together in this space, you can say whatever you need or whatever, however you feel, right? So what you're doing is you're creating safety. Mm-hmm. You're creating a container for them to have their own experience, right? And obviously you as the caregiver, it's going to be important for you. And this is the work of TriSofter and Strong Like Water. This is where we do the work of our own regulation first.
Right.
Because if you come into that conversation dysregulated, mm-hmm. you are not going to be able to help them hold their pain. It is going to feel way too big. And you might say something or do something that might be hurtful to your kiddo. And then they're not going to want to necessarily share that in the future. And if you've done that, there's ways to repair, right? I'm not saying it's like, it's not the end of the world, but this is the work of why we do our own work.
Right.
And it's not the only reason, because you in and of yourself matter. And as you do your own work, what literally happens is that your nervous system on a subconscious level actually relays cues of safety to those around mm-hmm. you. That's literally what happens when you are regulated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the final thought to that question is once the crisis has passed, to do your own, to do, and really, even if you're in the crisis, to do all that you can to connect to your own safety. But afterwards, going to your kiddos and having those other kiddos and sort of reestablishing that connection, having just time that is for them. Maybe that you couldn't do that 5 days ago, but once that has begun to pass, what you are also relaying to them, even from a body level, is also that it's over, mm-hmm. is also that you're here, is also that though there are going to be some times when, you know, this other safe adult is going to be more available to you, now that time is past and here
yes.
I am. Mm-hmm. And there was never a time that I didn't care about you, but it just for a brief time, I needed to be less available. But what happens with secure attachment when we practice that secure attachment is that it literally begins to be carried around in our bodies. Mm-hmm. Our kiddos begin to carry, as we practice the safe attachment with each other, they carry the imprints of that in their nervous mm-hmm. system. So there's just so much beauty and hope to that,
right?
Because it's not a one-time thing. Even if you've messed up, this is a practice. This is a way of being with ourselves, a way of being with our kids, a way of looking to repair.
Right.
And not even when you've intentionally sometimes messed up. Sometimes life is just hard and you have been not on the same page with your kids. When that is happening, when we go to them and we made that effort mm-hmm. to be with them, to see them, to hear them, we are practicing that co-regulation mm-hmm. and they are experiencing us as a safe attachment. And that is the core of the work.
Right. That is so great. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I could talk to you forever. I appreciate you so much for sharing that. I think that's going to be really helpful to a lot of our listeners. And if you haven't read Andi's books, they are so approachable and so many good practices. And I think it's really going to touch. I know some of our listeners have read you because they were like, you're going to talk to her. Yay. So where can people find you?
Yeah. Well, you can find me on my website, ondikolber.com. And I do have some free videos if that's something that would be helpful. So feel free to check that out. And then you can find me on Twitter at ondikolber and also on Instagram at ondikolber.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I hope everybody checks you out.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a great conversation.